You are listening to Fantha Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
That's not true. That's impossible.
You're listening to Making Tracks and a very special episode as Fantha Tracks return to Finse in Norway for Hoth Strikes Back, which took place at Hotel Finse 1222 on the weekend of the 23rd to the 25th of February 2024. Fantha Tracks presented two panels. The second was a Q&A with guests former Fox CEO Harald Lidstad, Martin Gant, who was a special effects technician on The Empire Strikes Back, and production assistant Christian Behrend. But first, it's our panel, led by Brian Cameron, on this very special episode of Making Tracks.
So, welcome to the panel for this morning, How the Empire Strike Fence. Me and Mark, I'm Brian, this is Mark. We're both from FanthaTracks.com, which is a daily Star Wars news site. Based in the UK, but we travel all around the world and do events and coverage of anything Star Wars. And really honoured to be asked to do the presentation this morning. And so got a lot to get through. So we're going to start by just talking a little bit about before The Empire Strikes Back and its conception. And George Lucas, when he was making Star Wars, had struck a deal with Alan Dean Foster to write the official novelization of the first film as part of that, and agreed to do a second book, which could be the sequel, which was Splinter of the Mind's Eye, Mark.
Yeah, when you think that when Star Wars came out, there was no guarantee it was going to be a hit. So just to make sure, as Brian says, as a backup, they do Splinter to make as a low budget, essentially a low budget TV movie or lower run cinematic experience, to the point where, as it says here, Lucas even asked for some dogfights to be taken out of the storyline so they could use sets and costumes and stuff that was there before. But of course, it was a bit of a hit, wasn't it, Star Wars?
It was. And as Harald mentioned last night, the budget for The Empire Strikes Back was really significant for its time. And so the whole idea of Splinter the Mind's Eye, they made a novel and we got Empire Strikes Back. As well as that, there was this background issue going on where Mark Hamill had a car crash and resulted in injuries and changes to his face. And there's always been this idea that perhaps the story for The Empire Strikes Back and the Wampa attack had been modified to help cover that. But maybe not so true, Mark.
Not so true. So when Lee Brackett did her first version of the Empire draft, which I think she only did one before she passed away, it included this Wampa attack scene in it. So Hamill's accident happened early 1977. They've still got pickups to do on the original film. They used doubles and stand-ins to do what they needed to do. So it actually had more of an impact on Star Wars, really, than it did on Empire. So I think it's kind of become the story that they added the Wampa scene and the sequences they did. And it probably made all the sense because, you know, he had this injury, but I think the story may have been conflated a little bit.
Yeah. And the kind of last kind of little bit of background information leading up to The Empire Strikes Back was the fire on the Shining set at Elstree.
Yeah, this is an interesting one because there's lots of little stories knocking around about this. Stage 3 burned down. It was an accident, air quotes, whereby the rumours were, true or not, that some of the crew got a call about 2 hours ahead of this accidental fire happening to say, you might want to get your drafts work and your paperwork out of there before this accidental fire happens. But anyway, Stage 3 goes down, it's where they shot The Shining, it's where they would shoot Raiders, I believe, one of the Souls, I think, was shot in there as well. But of course, it caused big issues for Star Wars, or for Empire, I should say, because they were already, at that point, having a few issues with budgets and such.
Yeah, and just a little bit of proof that the Wampa existed very much in early drafts, that very there early in the concept of The Empire Strikes Back as well. And I guess the last big concern before you even start shooting was the fact that they wanted it on a snow planet, and the difficulty that would entail for special effects. And I've just got a little clip here from
begins,
one of the documentaries.
As everything in movies does, with an attempt to solve a very basic problem. How to color in a screen that's as white and cold and empty as the ice planet of Hoth. The best way to fill in those blank spaces is through fantasy. And the country of fantasy has always been the breeding ground for mythical beasts, some of whom are friendly and helpful, like this Tauntaun, who provided transportation for us on Hoth. The only trouble with mythical creatures is that they're mythical. You can't go out and rent one at a zoo. You have to create them. But in creating them, you also create problems. As you can see, my life-size Tauntaun can't move. It has sawhorses where her legs should be. On location in Norway, Urban Kirshner, the director, had to shoot live action very carefully so it could be integrated with special effects material shot later.
All right. Yeah, of course.
To make my Tauntaun move, a miniature of her with a model of me aboard had to be created. That was then photographed one frame at a time through a process known as stop-motion photography at our special effects studio near San Francisco.
Okay. Shooting.
It takes Dennis Muren and Phil Tippett an hour just to make 1 second of stop-motion film. The adjustments between frames of all the tiny moving parts are minuscule, but projected at the proper speed, 24 frames per second, these individual movements will flow seamlessly together.
So that's a little bit of what the kind of planning and thinking to do before they started. And so we're going to try and tell you what I'm classing as the official Lucasfilm version of events.
There's a lot of air quotes going on.
There is a lot of air quotes there because we've got the perfect people in the Q&A later who can tell us what's wrong in the official Lucasfilm version and what's been made a little bit Hollywood. And we've got the perfect people to tell us the facts from the fiction. And we'll start going all the way back to April 4th, 1978, and they selected Norway, the location, and ideally picked because, as you can see outside, they just the expanses, the lack of foliage, and I think that one of the key aspects was being accessed by rail direct to where they needed to shoot and having actually a hotel here on location that they could use.
It's all really well finding the perfect location, like you say, if you haven't got the logistics to get there. Then it's not much use. So, and of course, back in '78, it was a slightly different world, and this was definitely the perfect place.
Yeah. So a lot of work had to happen over the course of that summer to make it possible to film here. We had in May '78, Gary Kurtz, Norman Reynolds, Robert Watts, all visited here, all working with people like you, Harold, setting up. Permissions from the government, everything from how you're going to do the banking and all that kind of things. You don't think about involved in bringing a film together, but all the things that had to happen to be here on location. And obviously being able to ship things in and how vital the rail network right out there proved to be. So fast forward a little bit to November 78, that was the first time Irving Kirshner was able to actually come out to location. Obviously because during the summer, completely different look to the environment. So he came out in November before the shoot. And there's a great story about how he was taken to the summit by helicopter and he asked to be left there so he could meditate and think about how they were going to do the shoot. And the helicopter broke down and couldn't return for him. We had to walk all the way back to base. And,
can you imagine doing that though, if you don't know really where you are, and you're not dressed for it, and you've got to walk 4 miles in that?
That's you've got the right director who's got the nerve to do that.
So I would say that on his first visit, he probably got a good foresight of how difficult the shoot was going to end up being. There was a lot of pride, I think, in bringing the production to Norway as well. And so very early, they were very public about coming here, very open with the press, and this terrific poster, which was part of the gift packs as well, which was fantastic, was released in January of 79. And there's a little insight as well to how detailed and complicated every kind of little operation was, in terms of who was going to be here, how they were going to do it, what was going to be transferred, and just a mountain of work going on behind the scenes. Progress reports going back to California as well as Austria, as to what's happening, who's travelling when, what vehicles were necessary, how the vehicles were getting there, transfers of fuel, and all the logistics.
It's interesting how closely Lucas needed to keep an eye on it, because he was putting a lot of focus on, obviously, an ILM at this point, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And so fast forward into January 1979, and they begin the preparations, and getting equipment to arrive, starting to build the camps, and everything involved, and starting the production together. And you have to remember as well, the nurses and the Red Cross have provided an important service as well as part of the film. And you can see some of the early work in building the trenches, what was involved in that, and building up the walls of the trenches as well. And it must have been sickening for the people doing it, because the amount of times they got filled in the snow and they're starting again. So. We can see a lot of video.
It's a very expensive operation. It's a long way from London, and what's more, it requires a lot of logistical coordination to get all the people and the equipment and everything up onto the top of the glacier.
Just shows you the kind of scale of what was happening. And you don't think about that often when you're watching a film where...
Oh, no, no. Like you say, there's a whole city behind what you see on the screen. But to get all of that, I was going to say Hollywood, it's not Hollywood, but it's a lot of British film crew and a lot of that equipment coming over from the UK and beyond to get it to here, and then to get it working, obviously, was quite the challenge.
A lot of thought had to go in the types of oils they were using, the effect it would have on the batteries and that they were using as well. And there was also a story of having to use razor blades to cut people's fingers off a metal that they'd been frozen to as well, which is kind of grim.
Hi, this is John Morton from The Empire Strikes Back, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
So, there was 10 containers of equipment sealed over from Felixstowe in England over to Oslo, and a further 3 flew in from Bergen. Different cameras that they used here as well. And interestingly enough, a lot of the more fragile items, the costumes and the makeup, were actually hand-carried over.
Yeah, I suppose you want to keep as close a hand on those as possible. And then also things like makeup and such, different techniques, things that might not work so well in a cold environment. I guess there was a lot of, figuring things out before they came here as well.
Absolutely. They had to import special vehicles, including snow tracks coming from Sweden. A rat track from Switzerland and four active snowmobiles as well. And the budget, they had the press conference in Oslo on the 1st of March. Again, really embracing the fact that they're filming over here in Norway. It's not something you tend to find in any kind of film production now, that they're so open in terms of what they're doing and these kind of press conferences. And they mentioned at the time that the budget was going to be 16 million, which would have been 67 million production today. I think it ended up being 22, 23 million.
It went up quite a bit. There's that infamous sort of story, which is nothing to do with this specifically, but there is that that whole story of the budget rising and the Bank of America being involved and so on and so forth.
And they were asked a question about what if the weather's bad at Finse, and Gary Kurtz suggested that that would be a good thing. He maybe came to regret that a little bit. And there's some photos as well from the press conference back then. I think some of them you'll see in display here in the hotel as well. And of course, it made a lot of press coverage. And one of the interesting things I didn't know until I was researching to do this panel was the fact that the interest that had been building up, because everyone knew they were coming to Norway to shoot the film, meant that the film never actually left cinemas. So in the spring of 79, when they were discussing re-releasing the film into cinema everywhere else in the world, they didn't have to in Norway because it was still showing.
I think, I don't know when did Norway, do you guys know when Norway got the original Star Wars?
Yeah.
Roughly, I mean.
26th of December.
There you go, so that's the same as, there you go, read the screen mark. So it's the same as the UK. So, of course, when the gap between Star Wars and Empire for us was less than it was for the Americans by quite a few months, but yeah, still, to be still running after all that time is hugely impressive.
We wanted to wait till the best cinema in Europe was ready, the Colosseum in Oslo. Yeah. So we just had to wait for the cinema to be
ready.
Clear. Yeah. So that's why it was in December.
Yeah, fantastic. Then everyone started moving up to Finse. There's a picture of Irving Kershner on the train. They all sort of arrived in different groups with Irving coming up on the second, and then the third, Mark Allen, Carrie Fisher, followed on with Carrie Kurtz. There's a picture, a great picture I think, of Carrie as well on the train. And of course, as Harold said, she wasn't part of the shoot at all, but she wanted to be part of the experience really.
That is one of the best pictures of Carrie ever though, isn't it? That's awesome. This is your favourite slide, Brian.
This is
your favourite slide.
This is my favourite slide. And I included it purely because of the quote from Brian Johnson as well, where he described what he felt like Finse was like. And he described it as a shelter for maniac Laplanders. So any maniac Laplanders here? But it shows you, I think there was a bit of discussion as well yesterday about the differences of the Norwegian crew, and they just got on with it, and the British crew were so reticent at the start, and I think that probably Brian Johnson probably puts that in the right category, and after a while I think they got stuck in and joined in, and it became quite a special bond I think between the whole crew.
I say, coming from a country where 2 inches of snow will stop everything, it was quite the change.
Yeah. And I think Jim Bloom took maybe a kind of attitude to it, in that he knew that things wouldn't go as planned, so it was a case of roll with the problems, I think. And you can see him there pictured as the Hoth Rebel commander that he also played in it. And they were there early, making sure that the camps were set up like they wanted as well. Got a little bit of insight into the camps as well. We had Camp Sharman at 3,000 feet in Camp Kurtz. At the summit at 6,000 feet, all heated, generators, toilets, emergency food rations. Did anyone try them? You guys on the crew? But they also had the snow-clad vehicles as well, that carried the same emergency packs as well. And there's a early map. I think some people have seen a different version of this one,
yeah,
where there's Camp Sherman's marked in next to the Blue House as well. And of course the hotel, but I've got the Joyous Haven this weekend as well. And the crew kind of took over all the rooms there. Every room marked out here, and how many could be in a room, whether the rooms had bathrooms or not. And I think you'll find out later today who was potentially in your room as well. They're working on that at the moment, so you'll maybe find out what member of the crew was in the room that you're staying in.
That's very cool.
And the shoot started on the Monday. Shot two scenes, Luke staggering out with the guards and Luke falling unconscious. It was the first day of a planned 76-day shoot. And on that day we had Mark Hamill, Dennis Austin, Peter Hamill and Des Webb all on the call sheet. Well, only Mark Hamill was used. And you can see a little clip from that day.
Working on a glacier during the worst March since the Norwegians started keeping records, you begin to have strange thoughts.
Straight ahead is towards the branch. Straight ahead is always towards the branch.
You begin to wonder, for example, if they've got any openings over in special effects. At least the work is indoors.
Cut!
Jedi Master who instructed me. Ben!
It's very cool. You don't often hear that scene at all without the music, so it's very cool to see that. I like to think Alec Guinness was there off camera with a megaphone feeding him his lines. I assume he probably wasn't.
And Mark kind of explained here as well that original plan was to be 90 minutes away from the hotel, but obviously all this was kind of shot from the back door, the fatal infamous back door, I think it's become. We also have the little bit of description of what it was like for him, the experience was like for him. And the kind of bit I liked best was the fact that Graham Feeborn, the chief makeup artist, would come out and basically rub snow in Mark Hamill's face, which must have been a great joy for him.
Like Mark says, it's one thing looking cool and looking like it's warm. It's another thing actually being warm, and clearly it wasn't the warmest outfit in the world.
No, absolutely not. And we also had the whole fact that the trenches were getting filled back in. An interesting little story here from Alan Tompkins as well about they got the help from a local who ran the local youth hospital, who was the expert in finding people stuck in avalanches, and he came out with a divining stick, and he was out there trying to help them find where the trenches were, so they knew where to dig them back up where they'd already had them prepared.
Because I guess it's like it was a blank slate every day, wasn't it? I guess you were just starting from scratch in that sense.
Yeah. Kirsten and the directors obviously determined to stick to the schedule. And that's why they made the option to shoot from right outside the film. And they also made the decision to bring Harrison Ford across.
That was a good decision, actually. Kirsch was, from what I understand, I did interview him years ago, and he was a fairly brisk director. He knew what he wanted. But conditions are what conditions are, so I guess it can slow things down. But bringing Ford across to shoot those scenes here, as opposed to shooting them back in the UK, was a sensible thing.
Yeah, because that was part of the decision, was the fact that we'd no longer shoot some of these scenes in studio as originally planned and conceived, that they would shoot them here on location. Yeah. And they actually had plans to shoot at Leeds Studio, and they were able to effectively cancel that whole plan, saving themselves some money and hassle, and setting up in a different studio in England. So a lot of story about Harrison Ford and how he arrived. Great controversy as to what one's accurate. I think Harrison has a nice Hollywood version of it. He recalled it that coming in and arriving, that nobody spoke a word of English, and that he was kind of dropped off at the train station and left to his own devices. Not so true, I think, as we've all come to learn. And Harold, you were one of the people to meet him, I think, along with Bjorn. And he actually even travelled across to Norway with Peter MacDonald as well. And so it's never quite abandoned and alone. But you explained the story fantastic last night in terms of how you travelled up and how you got here and the fun they had in getting up here. And he called it somewhat differently. He was determined that he went in the wrong direction and everything. Clearly there was a bottle of whiskey drunk that night, and we'll use that as the reason that his memories may be foggy. But in fairness to him, he arrived and he was there 7:30. He was up for the start of the shoot the following morning, and we were discussing this actually yesterday. Alan Tompkins talked about one of the biggest problems they had at the start of the shoot was a difficulty getting what they wanted from the two tauntauns, and they described that one of them being the actual weight of the skin and the size of the head for manipulating it. But I think there's a bit of dispute that might not have been the tauntaun he was referring to the wampa.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that in the Q&A later for sure.
Yeah. And we can see Des Webb in his wampa costume as well. And we've got a couple of clips.
So I'm pulled or hold, bang, dismount, run.
No,
you can lose it. It's gotta be
right, that's right.
That's why it has to be your ship, because there's nothing else will hold the pause. That's fine, it would
have goggles.
Looking back, all the way back. That's right. Back here. Find him. Take the stuff off. You're seeing it. That's it. Out.
That's it.
For everything in one location. Daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds. Bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
Very difficult to get what they wanted from them, and despite them being such impressive builds, I think.
They do look the business, don't they? But yeah, it's creature puppeteering and design and such has always come a long way since then.
And a great picture of Robert Watts as well, one of the Wampa arms. And you can see the Wampa in action.
Our snow monster, the Wampa, was actually an actor dressed in this costume.
Steady! Hey, steady girl! Hey, what's the matter?
You smell something? This is a shot I wish they could have gotten one take. Or done with mirrors. Or something. Not that Des Webb, who played the Wampa, had it easy. Des is 7'4". He was trying to walk in snow on 2.5-foot stilts. With his mask on, he was 11 feet tall.
So we moved on to March the 7th, and they're doing the Wampa Dragon look, and also Han on his tauntaun. And discussed, on that day, Alan Arnold interviewed Harrison Ford, and he talked about how important the camaraderie that he came across when he arrived at Finster was.
Yeah, to be in conditions that are alien to 99% of the crew flying in, certainly the guys who lived here are used to it, of course, but the British and American guys, not so much. So you really would have to get that sort of that group mentality to make it work and knuckle down, because the work's got to be done, hasn't it?
Yeah. And Alan Arnold discussed a story about one of the carpenters at breakfast saying to Mark Hamill that someone's going to go short because he had two glasses of orange juice. I should probably confess I had two glasses this morning as well.
Yeah, you did.
Yes. Well, Des, it's our big scene together. Are you dragging me by my arm or my leg?
Leg.
Oh, great.
Left leg.
Which one?
Anyway, just walk forward.
If we can turn around to us slightly.
Very important that when Alan starts pulling, he keeps a distance of the arm.
Like Windows, there is forward.
Okay, Des.
Right, lift.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to work. We'll have to do it with one hand.
It's the surface, and being not able to see anything when I'm inside the head, everything is just a complete nothing.
Come on down, Larry. All right, fine. Keep it short. All right, everyone, lift. Come on, give it a hand. That's it.
Same as before, really. Soft snow, find a little dip, and it's impossible to control exactly how you put your foot down. Looking your boots.
Do you want to take the weight on my shoulder, Dan? Are you coming back?
Well, no, I still wish I would come.
I think my favourite part from that clip, if you look closely, you could actually see one of the famous blue jackets worn by the crew inside the tauntaun as they're sort of giving it little flinches of the last weeks of life, because that was great fun. Moving on to the Thursday, March the 8th, it's time for Carrie Fisher to return to the UK for principal photography over there. And Alan Tompkins described that day that they must have done four or five sightseeing right outside the hotel, at least the shape of the snowdrift changed with every day. And we're going to get a chance just later this morning to go out with Christian, and he's going to, I think, do a tour outside the front of the hotels. And give us a little bit of insight into some of those scenes and shots as well. And I've got a couple of images here from Harrison Ford there, the tauntaun right in front of the hotel.
The jaw is there, that, the head, that, the eyes. Maybe you have to move a slide, so just give it a kick over.
Action!
Hold it. Moving on to Friday the 9th, and there started to be a little bit of a crossover as they start to wrap some of the first unit and some of the second unit people, including the people who become the rebel soldiers, start to arrive, Mark.
Yeah, it was a smart move to use the guys that they did as well, because being so familiar with the terrain, and it's always tricky, obviously, when you've got first unit, second unit doing stuff at the same time, because, as you say, they've got to send some of those guys back to Pinewood to start shooting at Elm Street to do their stuff back there.
Yeah, and the pressure started growing. Gary catches the decision out. At what point do they decide that we've got enough from the first unit and we move on to a second unit, because they couldn't hold up production up Elm Street purely because of what's been happening, like from The Shining and the delays that caused. So despite some optimism that the skies were cleaning up, the camps were again covered by snow, and then for the shoot they made it halfway to Camp Sherman, where they decided to film Lucas Wright, the tauntaun, like we just saw. And that was an image from that shoot, was actually the first picture released as the promotion of the movie, which is this very famous picture here.
Yeah, if anybody used to get the old Bantha Tracks, the old Lucasfilm Star Wars fan club, there was the fan club pack with six images, I think, if I remember, and that was one of them.
Yeah. And again, it was kind of highlighted. Harold told the story last night, I'll kind of recap it, you know, a little bit about the press intrusion and, you know, between Fox Norway and Lucasfilm, they really were trying to handle the press and keep them happy by giving them access that they probably wouldn't normally have received from any other kind of film, like this press release, like the press conference. But still, Rupert Murdoch's Sun newspaper couldn't contain themselves and went to great lengths and hide in a helicopter via the British Army and to come and land close so they could get photographs. Very, very dangerous.
Yeah, very. It shows the popularity of Star Wars, obviously, even at this point in the timeline of the Star Wars movies, that they would take that. It was quite a risky thing, given that the weather wasn't that good.
Moving on to Saturday the 10th, and it was one of the rare occasions where the weather cleared. They were able to move up to Camp Sherman and shoot at one of the locations that they selected back at the recce back in January. And Robert Watts described it as it was an ice slope, and it was a match shot for Luke walking towards his X-Wing fighter and seeing the Falcon fly out over his head. And I think that was one of the rare occasions where it actually got to shot at a planned location. Got behind the scenes of the pro buck here as well, which was part of the shoot on Saturday as well. And again, they chose to do some of the shots here because they had Harrison Ford on location. Probot was a nice little bit of technology as well. But Saturday was also so one of the more serious casualties of the shoot, with painter Gordon Wright slipping and breaking two ribs and ended up at hospital at Voss. We can have a little look at the Probot.
We also had to build the Probot, which is the probe that is sent down by Darth Vader that lands on the snow planet surface that then goes and looks for human life forms. Joe had already drawn the drawings, George liked that, but they were going to go to Norway to shoot all those scenes, and they needed a prop. They needed one that was like 9 feet tall or something like that in scale to have out in the distance.
Second clip as well.
When you look ahead, also look around. The stuff's still flying in the air. It just disintegrated. Wham!
Yeah. Up you come, Pete. Just rest your face. Keep coming, keep coming. Hold it there. Don't look at camera, no. Look to the right. I think we do talk about fear, so I don't think we're in any way.
In some respects, it's nice that you can hide behind a character and just sort of be yourself and get the character demonstrated.
So moving on to Sunday, which was an intense last day of shooting for the first unit. They wrapped up at 5:10 in the evening. Took their flights from Bergen to London on the Monday. And then again, Robert Watts sort of described the shoot. During the entire period of the first unit's shooting, they had one break of clear weather for half a day, and the rest of it was all a compromise. And I think that's a huge part of the story of the making of this film, is the way that the team came together and they found solutions regardless of the problems that were in front of them.
I think all location shooting to a degree is a compromise, but to get out what they did for such an amazing sequel, obviously, as Empire is a testament to everybody that had any hand in it at all.
So they ended up 52 setups, 7 scenes, screen time of 7 minutes and 39 seconds from the sheer amount of effort that went into bringing the shoot together. And there's a couple of images from that last day of the first unit shooting as well. And there's always this great debate as well about where Dennis Lawson featured in the shoot, and never been able to find a photo or a video where you could really confirm that it was him. And so if anyone ever comes across anything, I'd love to find out. And you can see some more amazing shots from what was going on in that shoot on that day. and it's a lot of video.
That's it? Okay, set it up right here. Okay, wrap up, fellas. We're moving down. Moving down to Camp Sherman.
Let's get out of here. Let's get down to Camp Sherman as soon as we can. Star is coming.
Access because of the railroad, very easily accessible. However, this weather is more fierce than is usually the case.
Gary Kirk's himself described the song there, but he described the experience of working in Norway and how he just thought everything was amazing. And as Harold pointed out, he still wore his jacket when he was at Elstree. And I think a big part of that was he took great pride in what it achieved out here.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah, you do see in quite a lot of shots he's got that jacket on. Yeah, that's a good point.
And of course, every day of the shoot, they were sending back progress reports on what they did. And you can find so much of these documents out there when you start researching what they did. And all the information about there at the bottom, you can read about a rock hitting one of the snow traps that needed to be repaired. One of the crew coming out and having their Motorola confiscated at airport security. lots of little funny elements of what had gone on.
It means absolutely nothing to anybody, but that was my 8th birthday, 31st of March 79. So.
And moving on to Monday the 12th, all the way through to April the 3rd, the second unit really took over. All the incredibly hard work at the battlefield and the trenches. 43 extras, 2 stuntmen, and Peter MacDonald taking on direction with a new Empire Flex camera as well, and some scenes as well shot where the stuntmen were doubling for Luke and Han.
I mean, this was, as a second unit, was a major undertaking, wasn't it?
Yeah. So the sheer scale,
big scale stuff.
Yeah. And when it came to shooting on the blue ice, we filmed the entrance for the X-Wing fighters to the rebel base as well. And they completed their shot on the first day. When they returned for the second day, they found 5 igloos with local students camped up on their shooting location. Again, as well, the work with the helicopters as well. Described that climbing up to 15,000 feet and then switching power off and then falling at 30 miles an hour, as well as flying at 100 miles an hour just 4 feet above the ground, which I think Alan Arnold described in his book that had to make sure the landscape was flat when they were doing that.
That's the background plates they shot there for the opening scene with the Tauntaun. If you watch Light and Magic, yeah, it's a brilliant scene where Dennis Muren describes how they placed the Tauntaun into the shot, which is fascinating.
Yep. And on the 1st of April as well, they shot Hamel Seam. It was actually Skeepin that was there, Luke falling from the Tauntaun. And 2 days later, they were wrapping, April 3rd. And of course, on April 3rd, inevitably there was an avalanche. That was a great way maybe to summarise the end of the shoot. And we can see some clips from the battlefield filming.
For the climactic battle scene shot on location in Norway, we used a mountain rescue team as rebel soldiers.
Started now.
Yeah.
The attackers are coming from over there, and you're shooting at them. There's explosions going on all around you. Okay? So go down the trench, and I'll come and give you something.
Assistant Director Bill Wesley was not always certain he was getting through to his Norwegian troops.
Make the bloody thing work, yeah? You finish! That sort of thing, okay? Good lad, it's you. This thing has got a bit of a kick to it, I would think. So, it's gone. You know, that kind of thing, yeah? The Empire is coming from that direction, which are 40-foot giants. You can't see them if you map them on.
Here we go then. Action!
Explosion one.
Hello, man, David.
Terrific, Cam. Three. Explosion three. Four.
And there's a second clip as well. It's kind of shows us the scale of everything.
You'll be busy.
Start charging now.
Yes.
From the middle of the track.
Group two now, please. Group two.
I'll be able to stand over that side because they're shooting in that side.
Okay. Good lad, you are just preparing for it.
I have no idea if it's a total joke, but go off to the left.
The war has started now.
Yeah.
The attackers are coming from over there, and you're shooting at them. There's explosions going on all around you. Okay?
Hello, I'm Dennis Lawson, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks.
And I thought it was worthwhile, just as we wrap the end of the shoot as well, to hear from Herman Kersner, so I've got a short clip from him as well.
We get to Norway, and I couldn't get out of the hotel to shoot, because there was a wall of snow that was blown in that night. So we put the camera in the doorway of the hotel, going out the back door. The crew was all inside, toasty warm, and Mark had to go out into the snow and go running away from the ice creature. And we never left the doorway. And he froze to death and we were fine. We finally shot all the scenes, knowing where the special effects, where this thing would come down, the foot would come down, and all this stuff.
And of course, we've got one of the famous photos of some of the crew together as well. And I'm just going to run through quite quickly, Mark, just a few photos from the second unit shoot, because the sheer scale of the shoot is impressive, because I think today we're kind of used to depth and scale in the films with the ability they've got special effects. But you know from seeing the clips and the photos, the sheer physical size of the shoot, it was something else.
It helped as well, I think, because it is almost a night campus. It's not because of the geography and such. But in terms of scale and distance, it just gives you such a feel of, that depth. Like you say, it's difficult to really get across what a good job they did of that.
Just some impressive photographs as well of what's going on. I mentioned earlier in the clips about taking the footage, combining it with some of the animatronic work and some of the map paintings as well, and how they brought it all together for the final shoot there. Obviously we're all here on location. It's something special, I think, to actually be able to be on a Star Wars location and experience a little bit of what the crew experienced back then. And we've put together a map. If you head to that address, it'll come up in your Google Maps. So when you're actually out there, if you venture out very far, you'll find the GPS locations. Each of the stars have different shooting locations. I've got question marks on three of them, purely because we think that's where they shot them. We don't know 100%. And that's a lot to do with the fact that where they were necessarily heading that day to shoot, they maybe didn't get to the exact location, but they maybe stopped before. Hopefully that'll help some of those that are out there find the shooting locations, and you'll know you are exactly on the spot. I just want to wrap up by a little bit on the critical reception of the film, and we see this a lot lately. With social media criticising things, but even Empire Strikes Back wasn't free of it at the time.
No, Empire was weirdly not massively well received on initial release. It did crazy money, biggest film of the year. It's a grower, definitely, and it has its place in the trilogy. It was never made to be a bookend. It was never made to have a conclusion. It was definitely a middle chapter of a trilogy. But yeah, here Pauline Kael saying what she says there, it's definitely worth a read, and her descriptions of these characters and creatures, it's kind of priceless. Yoda looks like a wonton and talks like a fortune cookie is the takeaway line for me.
It's a case of never listen to the media, isn't it? How wrong were they?
Big time wrong.
It's 45 years later and we're sat here talking about this film. If one word what the critics said at the time was true, none of us would be here. And I think that kind of sums up, a film so wonderfully appreciated by the fandom, to the point we spoke about last night about how even the crew jackets are famous to the fans. I think people appreciate what went into making this film, probably more than any of the Star Wars films, purely because people, I think, realise the effort and the struggles that went into making it. And that kind of wraps up our panel for today. Just a few people I want to give some credit to that were great sources and information for this, and I think I've had great fun already speaking to people here. I've got a huge amount of knowledge about the shoot as well and learning more. We've got the Q&A later with the special guests as well, which they're going to correct all the mistakes from the official story that I've just told you, and answer all your questions as well. And that is us for this morning. Thank you. And Donald.
I do want to thank you for a very, very interesting and good presentation. It was extremely interesting. And I think a couple of us, we were back 45 years ago seeing this. And just to remind you, on the press conference, Gary Kurtz said that he wanted some bad weather. I do think we did deliver, as you saw. So thank you very much. This was great.
If you want to be part of the action, visit fanthatracks.com, or be sure to comment, like and share on our social media feeds at Fanthatracks. Send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@fanthatracks.com. Subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Temple for composing the Fanthatracks intro, Adam O'Brien for our making tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Tune in to Good Morning Tatooine. It's live Sunday evenings, 9 o'clock UK, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, on Facebook, YouTube and Twitch. And check out our Fanthatracks Radio Friday night rotation every Friday at 7 o'clock UK time for new episodes of The Phantom from Down Under, Planet Layer, Desert Planet Discs, Start Your Engines, Collecting Tracks, Cannon Fodder, and special episodes of Making Tracks, and every Tuesday at 7 o'clock UK time for your weekly episode of Making Tracks. And remember, Fanthatracks.com, our social media feeds, Fanthatracks TV and Fanthatracks Radio are absolutely free! So no Patreon, Buy Me A Coffee, Kickstarter or Indiegogo required to stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news.
Until we catch up with you again, may the Force be with you.
Coming up next on Fanthatracks Radio, it's Making Tracks.